Friday, June 11th, was one of the longest and most memorable days I've spent in the White House. It began at 6 o'clock. This time, I was going to be on time at Mount Vernon. Makeup and combing by Mr. Jolloway. And he deserves some sort of battle medal after these early hours. And then, leaving about 7:30. I always wonder why I don't get up earlier when I see how beautiful the world is in the pearly morning. And driving out to Mount Vernon. This time, they were set up on the front lawn, not the riverside. Somehow or other, the lighting had worked out poorly before, although it was a magnificent day, and we all felt so hopeful about it. Once more, Mr. Waltz had coffee and sweet rolls set up for us in his office, and even the last of the strawberries from George Washington's garden, still practically dewy, their stems on, to be dipped in powdered sugar. But it was an hour or so before we stopped in to refresh ourselves with them. The work went fast, and we thought well. The funny hazards we've encountered, fly landing on my cheek when I was in the middle of a script, constant planes going over, the boat running aground, none of these happened today. From where I worked, it seemed a smooth day. I didn't know that just an hour or so before that, the assistant's director was frantically trying to get Washington police to wake up the driver of the truck with all the machinery. He'd set his alarm clock for 5 o'clock. It had failed to go off. He had slept through. When she arrived, none of their enormous equipment was on the spot. It had just been like the last frantic days of a campaign, but he'd gotten out there. Mad Paul Revere sort of dash, I hope within the limits of the law. And everybody frantically had gotten the equipment up. Just as I walked in. It was the fastest day we'd ever worked, and by 9:30 we were through and had gone in to have our second cup of coffee with Mr. Waltz and to thank him for being so cooperative. He'd ratted the tourist around the front way. I tried to apologize to them for whatever they'd missed of George Washington's home by giving them an extra wave and a smile as I passed. I told Mr. Waltz there's one more thing I'd like to do before I left. My favorite thing at Mount Vernon is the kitchen garden, the vegetable garden. So he and I went over there. He called the head gardener, very elderly man, bending over his work. John and Helen Jean Secondary went with us, and several of the others, Indian Joe, I believe, and Mr. Rasty, and the assistant director. I love the espaliered pear trees and other little fruit trees that I don't even know the name of. Of course, the grapevines and the fan-shaped espaliered peach trees along the old brick wall of the garden. The dinner plantation bell. And the fact that it looks used. And the river in the distance. And the round pool of water bricked up several feet high. I think it must have been there earlier for purposes of watering. Now Mr. Wald says his grandchildren go swimming in it. The box is some of the most magnificent in this country, I'm sure. The cameras kept on clicking as the gardener and I and Mr. Waltz walked around. And then at the last moment, Mr. Waltz presented me the great armload of magnolia blossoms, smelling like heaven, taking me right back to my childhood at the brick house. I was delighted. He must have seen how much so in my face because he offered me a magnolia seedling from one of the handsome trees on Mount Vernon's lawn for the White House. I accepted at once. Mr. Williams will find a choice spot for this. I asked him to get in touch with Mr. Williams about it, wishing to myself I had nerve enough to say, and couldn't I have another one for our own ranch in Texas? With very fond thanks, we said goodbye, and I was back at the White House by 10:20, ready to work on my mail. Lyndon had planned to go to Texas for the weekend, and I earned my days off during the next few hours, working at my desk and on all the household details. And then, at a little past 2, Lucy and Bill went with us. We choppered to Andrews and were off to Houston to meet the astronauts. We thought of asking them to come up to the ranch to spend the weekend with us, but it was decided this would center the attention upon these three couples, whereas it was better, from the national standpoint, to center the attention, the praise, the homage of the country to the whole Manned Space Center, because this is the work of hundreds, thousands of hands, and not just the glorified few who actually fly in the space machine. And so began a few hours that so barely skimmed the surface of a great experience that it left me dizzy. I wished I'd seen what I saw. At Houston, we went straight to the Manned Space Center, which is mushroomed up, and some streamlined modern buildings, thousands of people, the greatest skills, all brought together there in a matter of months. Just the physical setup itself, an achievement. Albert Thomas had been too ill to go. That means he must be ill indeed. Jim Webb was with us, and Linda never lost an occasion to let the whole crowd know how much he admired him. In a great flurry of cameras and people, we met the young astronauts, Major McDivitt and Major White, and their families and parents. And then, in only a moment, found myself seated on a front row, looking out on the assembled workers at the Space Center, while Jim Webb said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States." And Lyndon gave the words of accolade for the first man to walk in space, to his partner in the ship, and to their partner on the ground, who was as responsible for its success as they were, and to all the thousands that had worked on it. They were a delightful young couple, McDivitt and White and their families, sort of fresh scrubbed and normal and excited. I'd like to apply that rather overused word, American. I was as thrilled as anybody present, except their mothers and their wives. The part of Lyndon's speech that brought the most clapping was when he announced that they were being promoted to colonels. And the picture of the day for me came a few minutes later. Lyndon striding at the head of the group with a fast pace, the rest of us hurrying to keep up. And right behind him, side by side, Major McDivitt and Major White racing along, and suddenly reached over and hugged each other for all the world like two little boys. Told their wives how much we were looking forward to having them at the White House, and we'd make sure the children saw everything from the most revered historical item to our dog him. We went into a vast auditorium-like room where the mission control crew had dozens, almost hundreds, desk-like things in front of them, sort of like the consoles in a TV room. Lots of buttons and flickering lights. We saw the EKGs of McDivitt and White in flight. There were some voice tapes of their conversation from space. We examined a spacesuit, an enormous, cumbersome thing, not unlike what I vaguely remember seeing in science fiction some 10 or 15 years ago. And then, in the manner of the world we live in, we too were off in a plane, but headed for a much quieter destination, this time in the little plane for the ranch. The big one had everybody else aboard. Had gone on. I was looking forward to this weekend particularly because Abe and Carol had come down with us. Carol so afraid of airplanes, but deciding to do it for once because this ought to be the biggest and safest of planes. And just as a sort of a gift to her husband, I hope a little bit because she wanted to be with us. Anyhow, there's no two I would rather have for a weekend. And to add icing to the cake, Bill Douglas, traveling in the Big Bend country for material on a book of mountains of the Southwest, had decided a few days ago to come to the ranch and absorb a little of the feeling of our own hill country, a sort of an extra chapter to his book. Lyndon had talked to him and asked him to bring any friends, make himself completely at home, and to wait for us on the weekend. And so he had. He was traveling with a Dr. Carell, a botanist, and a Mr. and Ms. Jim Bomer and Mrs. Burleson, whom he had met delightfully enough on floating down the Rio Grande in the canyon portion of the Big Bend country. He and Dr. Carell were established in the main guest room at the ranch. The Bomers and their children and Mrs. Burleson had also been in the ranch. I'd sent word ahead to make them comfortable at the Lewis so the Fortises could be with us in the gay room upstairs. Logistics, beds and travel and meals do need some attention around this place. Lyndon, like a man athirst in the Sahara, was rushing us all to get on the chopper for the boats, and in a matter of moments I'd equipped Carol, whose suitcase wasn't here yet, with a bathing suit, but no flats for her tiny feet, and a sun hat, and Abe and Carol and Lyndon and I and a few of the office staff choppered over to the Haywood, where Bill Douglas and A.W. and Dr. Carell were already out in the boat. Bill, in that wonderful fashion he has, finding the most adventurous things to do in any region, had already been to Enchanted Rock, and I believe Hamilton Pool, and the Three Springs Ranch, and the site of the old Mormon colony, and had learned unnumbered things about Texas wildflowers and odd trees, even the Madrona, from Dr. Carell. It was quite rare for a while we watched Lyndon in the little boat with the demonstrating water skiers. And then we all lay on the upper deck, the big boat, as many of us as could stretch out with pillows, and watch the moon, the same moon that I had seen begin in Caneo Bay, in such interesting conversation. Dr. Correll once worked for Lawrence Rockefeller. Now he works for something called Texas Research Foundation, which is cataloging the plant life of Texas, among other things. One of its aims, this we talked about, is to find something to control aquatic growth in Caddo Lake, which is ruining a once beautiful region, picturesque, historical, delightful recreation spot, also a long-time source of income to all the fishermen and camp owners. It was as interesting an evening as I have spent on the boat. Nobody's more fun to listen to than Abe and Bill, and Dr. Correll proved a fascinating new addition. They all shared my love of the long twilight cheer. As the sun set, great pink billows of clouds made the evening a delight, and then the moon turned from the faintest white shadow to brighter silver, and we went back to the Haywood. There we met the Jim Bomers, Mrs. Burleson, and it turns out that they're both law partners of our old-time friend Byron Skelton, loyal Democrat through the thin days. They live in Temple, and they're members of the Texas Adventurers Club. First thing I'll join when I'm out of this job. Next, the Audubon Society. Next, some good garden club. Dinner on the patio under the full moon was delicious, and Dr. Correll told me a story about a trip he'd made into the depths of the Big Thicket in East Texas, where an old-timer had led him to a spot where he saw two Cape Jessamine trees, not bushes, trees, about 25 feet high, and a spread of some 40 feet, he said, loaded with white blossoms, and you could drown in the smell. He said the man knew he could probably bring some nurseryman to them. Nobody but a native could possibly find them in the Big Thicket. And maybe he could sell them for thousands of dollars to be transported to some rich man's garden. But he'd just rather leave them there. Dr. Correll is very keen about Texas' future. He's transplanted from somewhere up east, Massachusetts, I believe. Carol was so surprised at the lake and the life along it, and the many wildflowers that are still in bloom, although it's just the end of the season. Having her here is a special treat for me. Just as we sat down to eat, I had passed by the great gardenia bush behind the Haywood house. I picked a blossom for each of the ladies, some dozen or so. It was loaded. And that is what touched off Dr. Correll's story about the Cape Jessamine tree. But it was a day that began at Mount Vernon with an armload of magnolias and went on through space and ended at Haywood with a bouquet of gardenias. A truly wonderful day to be alive. And so Lucy must have thought, too, because she had asked her daddy, in her very sweet way, if she could use a car to go and see a friend. Her daddy had said, yes, of course. She had smiled happily and said, oh, Daddy, thank you. Which car may I use? And Daddy had smiled equally and said, you just use anyone you want. So when we woke up next morning, we found that Lucy had chosen the best Lincoln and had departed to see the friend. I felt a good deal of a louse for not telling Lyndon that the friend lived in Lubbock, almost clear across the state of Texas, 8 hours' drive away. But that feeling was softened by knowing full well that some of my own best memories are of the silliest, gayest, probably wildest things I did, rather than of the stodgy things, and that you're only 18 once. Besides, I trust Lucy, and she thrives on it.